Yes, may it please the Court, I am Ken Anderson with the Federal Defender's Office. For the Central District of Illinois, representing the appellant Neil Allen. In this case, Mr. Allen lied about his educational and employment background. The end result of this was that, well, not the end result, but the attorney for the Lac du Flambeau Band of the Chippewa Tribe hired him and his company to do mold testing and remediation on the reservation. And this ultimately resulted in him being charged with and pleading guilty to mail fraud. This is an unusual mail fraud case, though, in that Mr. Allen actually performed the work that he contracted to do for the tribe.
Well, but whatever services he provided, they were not the services that the tribe contracted for, in the sense that they were not provided by someone with the credentials that Mr. Allen represented he had. So, you know, why does he get credit for whatever the value of his services might have been? They needed someone with really superb credentials for what was coming next.
That is what they thought they were hiring. Mr. Allen did perform the physical services that he contracted to do. Whether the tribe could have found somebody else, we don't know. And certainly, it's quite possible that because he didn't have as much expertise as he claimed, that diminished the value of his services. But that doesn't mean that his services were actually worthless. Similar cases of misrepresentation, this court has found that the appropriate restitution is the difference between what a victim received and what they contracted for. And certainly the testing itself, plus the remediation training and everything, had some, it looks like, quite a bit of value. Mr. Allen's charges were less than a couple competitors, and, well, there's no evidence in the record what their qualifications were. For all we know, they weren't any greater than what Mr. Allen genuinely possessed. Instead, the court declined to make the determination. It just said that it would be unduly burdensome to the court to determine the value of Mr. Allen's services. And while a court can refuse to order restitution based on that consideration when it would unduly complicate or prolong sentencing, it can't do the opposite and say, I'm just going to go with what the probation officer says because it would be too hard to determine it. The restitution order does have to be supported by the record. The government claims that Mr. Allen waived this objection, first points to the plea agreement. The plea agreement only said that if the parties couldn't agree, the judge would make the determination. It didn't say that the judge could refuse to make the determination or that she could order excess restitution. In addition, Mr. Allen didn't withdraw his argument at sentencing, as the court was aware when it pointed out the argument and said that, you know, it wasn't going to decide it. Certainly the court thought that it was still pending at that point, which, you know, is the whole purpose of an objection.
Is it your position basically that we have no way to review the discretion exercised or lack of discretion exercised by the judge here?
Yes, it is. You know, I point to the probability of excess restitution simply to show that Mr. Allen was prejudiced by the court's failure to make the determination.
Well, the judge made this assessment that she estimated that it was unlikely the purported value would exceed the $81,000 the tribe expended. And you're saying there's no record to support that conclusion at this point. It might be, but it just hasn't been made. Is that?
Well, that's true. Plus, she shouldn't have used any unsubstantiated loss to offset restitution. Unsubstantiated costs can't support an order of restitution regardless. But, yes, we don't know the exact amount. For all we know, if Mr. Allen had had the expertise, his services would have been worth more than what he was paid. What he did was worth it.
But what you, on the other hand, what you want is
less.
Some,
we don't know.
What you want is some explanation. Right?
Yes. The court should have delved into it and made the determination, and that would have given us hopefully an accurate accounting of how much, if anything, Mr. Allen owed the tribe.
Tell us again why this wasn't waived, though, this argument.
Well, first, as I said, the plea agreement didn't say the court could do anything it wanted. It just the standard thing that if the parties can't agree, the court make the determination. Well, that's what always happens with or without a plea agreement. In fact, the court makes the ultimate determination even when the parties do agree. And in addition, the court clearly thought that at sentencing, this objection was still before it when it just said, you know, it'd be too much for me to decide, so I'm not going to do that. The record prior to that was perhaps somewhat ambiguous, but that certainly shows that the person to whom it mattered knew the objection was still pending. The government also argues that Mr. Allen's objection was inadequate and lacked support. However, Mr. Allen gave an amount when he said that he didn't think he owed any restitution because he thought services were worth at least what he was paid. And this is supported by the fact that Ms. LeCount, and as I said, the tribe obtained the two other bids that were higher, and she made the legal judgment that the testing was necessary. Neither Mr. Allen or any of the government's experts were in a position to question that legal judgment. Contrary to the government's statement, Mr. Allen never said that no testing was necessary. He did say that he told the tribe that some of it wasn't necessary, but that they wanted it done anyway. That wasn't resolved. Fact is, people have unnecessary work done on their property all the time. Just because it's unnecessary doesn't mean they don't still have to pay for it. You know, maybe they want it for cosmetic reasons. You know, wasn't the case here, but you know, and of course, as I said, there was prejudice because restitution's limited to what the tribe could have obtained in a civil suit. They would have had to show that but for the deception, they wouldn't have paid the amount, and they probably couldn't have done that, at least in whole. You know, maybe they could have in part, but if Mr. Allen wasn't hired, they would have hired somebody else to do the same work. And it's, as I said, undisputed that not only did Mr. Allen and his company do the work, but they did it properly. The government even conceded there was no proof that his charges were excessive. Instead, the government simply points to an application note under loss amount, which says that licensed professionals don't get any credit for the value of their, or people who claim to be licensed don't get any credit for the value of their services. That's irrelevant and inaccurate. One, it's irrelevant because that goes to loss amount, which is separate from restitution, and it's also wouldn't apply anyway because Mr. Allen never claimed to be licensed. Wisconsin doesn't license microbiologists. I see I'm getting into my rebuttal time, so thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Mr. Charoz.
Thank you. If it may please the court. Based on the plea agreement and Allen's conduct at the sentencing, he has no basis to object to the court's award of restitution in this case. First, as this court has held in Peterson, a defendant may bargain away the right to have his own determination or hearing on the amount of restitution by allowing the court to make that determination. That's what this court ruled in Peterson, and that's what the defendant...
But it's true. I mean, it's true that the plea agreement gave Judge Crabb the power to resolve the amount of restitution, but he didn't waive, it seems to me, the right to appeal her ruling if he thought she was wrong. And after the initial round of objections to the PR, to the PS, to the pre-sentence report, Judge Crabb indicated that she would resolve this issue at sentencing. I'm having a hard time understanding why he was obliged to object again, or why you think he forfeited this appeal. I'm really having a hard time.
And we can certainly just go to that exact language, which is in the government's appendix at the sentencing hearing. The court first asks, Mr. Allen, do you have any of, have you read and read the pre-sentence reports? Yes, yes, yes. Everybody's read the pre-sentence reports. Then the question is asked, Mr. Allen, do you have any objections that your attorneys have not raised? No, I do not. That's on page 5, supplemental appendix of the government at the sentencing hearing. Because the court's going to say, well, is there anything for me to decide here? She then turns to the attorneys. Are you still making those objections? And they say, no, we are not. We are not. And they say, they go to the loss calculations. See, we don't disagree with the loss calculations or anything else. Again, that's pages 3 through 4 of the sentencing transcript. It's very clear what the court is asking at that point. Or 3 through 5, excuse me, and in the government's supplemental appendix. And then at that point, we get into the restitution issue. And the court says, okay, the restitution amount. Mr. Allen, we're going to give you credit for the $2,500 microscope that you're willing to donate to the tribe. The restitution amount is now what? And they come up with the figure, I think it's $291,623. It's in the record. It's in the transcript. Defendant's counsel then says, is that correct? And defendant's counsel says, for the record, we agree with that amount of the restitution. And then the court turns to Mr. Allen and says, Mr. Allen, do you have any thing to add? No, I don't. And just as in the Brody case, which I submitted in the 28J letter, this becomes the paragon of waiver. In other words, the defendant is given numerous opportunities. He knows how to read a pre-sentence report and make objections. He did that already. The court had the preliminary rulings based upon the entire record in this case because there was a constant interplay between what that restitution amount was going to be and what the loss amount was going to be. And when
Why does she then say at some point, it's too burdensome for me to calculate what the amount is?
Well, and I think, and again, you have to understand that it's not that she's making a specific ruling, and I'm not going to try to get into Judge Crabb's mind except to say that it's not inconsistent to believe that I've resolved that issue, but I'm also going to add some additional information, which is, look, it's too burdensome for me to work on it. It wouldn't matter anyways. And these are offhand comments that are not made. They are superfluous to the real issue here.
Your position is then that they specifically agreed to that amount, even though Judge Crabb said, well, it's too burdensome for me to be specific on how I got there.
That's correct. I think that they specifically waived it. I think, again,
at one point in the record, again, Mr. Droz, do you say they waived it?
It is on pages 3 through 5 of it, of the sentencing transcript.
And what occurs?
What occurs is the first question asked is, have you read the pre-sentence report? Do you have any objections other than the ones your defendant, your counsel raised? No, I don't.
Well,
that's the first one.
They had raised an objection to the restitution.
I'm sorry.
No, had they not raised an objection to the restitution amount?
That's correct. So, but they're asking him, do you have anything your counsel raised? No, I don't. Then they go to his counsel. Do you have any objections? Are you going to continue your objections? And they say, no, we are not.
She's asking, are you continuing your objection and referring to the original objection to the restitution amount?
Referring to the entire set of objections, and they come back and they narrow it, according to the defendants.
But the very fact that they narrow it, what are they narrowing?
Your Honor, they may be narrowing it down to the loss calculations or the specific things that they enumerate, but it then goes back on page 5, and I can go get that part of it.
We can do that.
But on page 5, the court then gets to the restitution issue and the microscope, which is, I think, critical. Because then the court comes up and they're going, okay, we're going to get to this restitution amount, and the restitution amount is going to be offset by this microscope. Right. And they say, on the record, we agree.
agree, what are they agreeing to, the microscope, or are they agreeing to the restitution amount?
Well, I would say that they're agreeing to the restitution amount. Otherwise, it would make no sense. They would say, no, that can't be it, Judge, or that's going to be something else. There would be something that would be said.
Well, why would, referring again to Judge Kenney's inquiry, it's hard to understand the burden then that the judge would feel about arriving at a calculation if we had an agreement.
Well, I can't explain that.
I know you can. I mean,
but I don't. What I'm simply saying is that I think that those. I don't think it's a necessary statement. I think that there's a lot of statements that are made during a sentencing that aren't necessarily determinative.
Well, if we didn't accept the waiver position, and this was remanded, you might come out the same way. I mean, you might even come out. I mean, the risk here of remand is if there was an inquiry made, maybe it would not even be beneficial to the defendant. I don't know.
Well, it's just not necessary.
But let's just assume, arguendo, we were to find that a waiver didn't occur here.
And if that's the case, it's still the defendant's conduct has no value. And that's critical to understand here on two bases. One, he wasn't the expert they contracted for, and he didn't do the work competently or adequately. It had to be redone. But more important, and equally as critical, is that it had no value because it wasn't necessary to the contract in the first place. And that's the record before the court. The record before the court, through the government's expert, both in the response to the objections and into the supplement, is that it had no value. What the defendant did was sell testing that had no value. The problem is that the government agrees, the testing was competently done, and the tests by Aerotech were competently done, but it wasn't necessary to do. And if I dare say, if somebody's trying to sell me a cure for baldness, and for the record, I have standing to make this argument, and yet they told me I'm going to first do the test to tell you whether or not you're bald, would be a ridiculous test. And yet the defendant would come back and go, but I want the money for telling Mr. Jaros that he was bald. And that's what they're trying to argue here. The mold testing on the record and by the experts and by nothing by the defendant. The defendant presents nothing, and that's critical to understand here because it goes back to the whole concept of waiver. Why is there no adequate record, as the defendant's arguing? Because they withdrew their arguments, they presented nothing, and the only record was what the government presented, carrying its burden. The government presented the evidence that said, by two experts, this testing isn't necessary. It was all superfluous. So that, it's almost a little disingenuous to come in and claim that somehow that the court didn't make an adequate finding and yet at the same time withdraw the objections, not present any evidence to the contrary, and then just act like, well, there was no finding made. Well, it wasn't necessary to make it. And that really is what we're getting at here. The government believes there was a waiver and believes also that the defendant's conduct had no merit.
Well, there is a number at the end of all this.
Absolutely. And that number is the loss of the contract price and the amount that he owed to Aerotech for the lab testing. And that is the number the court came up with.
Less the microscope.
Well, less the microscope, right. And the court made that finding.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Yes, with respect to the waiver, initially, counsel and Mr. Allen only said that they didn't have any further objections to the offense level. In fact, counsel said, as reflected in the second addendum with the correction, taking off the two levels for abuse of trust and winding up with a total offense level of 17 and advisory range of 24 to 30 months, we have no objections to those calculations. That certainly doesn't explicitly refer to restitution. And later on, yes, certainly there was an agreement that the microscope would be forfeited and go towards restitution. Beyond that, it's not as clear as it'd like. But Most importantly, the court ultimately says, although you've suggested that the tribe's pecuniary loss should be reduced by the actual value of the services provided, trying to calculate that value would place an undue burden on the court. That, I don't know how the could be any clearer of an indication that the court thought the objection was still before it. And the government also, of course, argues that the value of the services also was unnecessary. There's a couple problems with that. One, it doesn't really matter if that's what the tribe wanted. And Ms. LeCount did say she needed at least some of the homes tested. Two, even aside from that legal determination, which is unquestioned, their government didn't show that none of the testing was necessary. Their experts said that testing is only necessary in certain conditions, but there's no evidence as to how many of the homes had those conditions and how many of them didn't. Presumably, not all of them were the same. In addition, there's no evidence that any of the work had to be redone over and above what the contract was. The government's simply referring to one of Mr. Allen's employees couldn't find the work that he did, so ended up redoing it, but the tribe didn't pay any extra money for that. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr.